That's Wisconsin-born mezzo-soprano Kit Reuter-Foss with O Mio Bambino Caro from Johnny Schicchi by Puccini, performing with the UW Marching Band led by Mike Lecrone. Kit Reuter-Foss made her Metropolitan Opera debut as the second lady in the Magic Flute under the baton of James Levine. She returned to the Met for La Traviata, Falstaff, The Marriage of Figaro, the world premiere of The Ghosts of Versailles, and the Met debut of Rusalka by Dvorak and also Death in Venice. She sung with many opera companies throughout the United States, but how did she make it to the Met in the first place, and what's it like behind the scenes there? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What prompts a singer to go into opera in the first place? And what do you do if your voice isn't always up to it? Those are just some of the questions that we have for our guest, Kit Reuter-Foss.
And welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, opera with the UW Marching Band right there seems an ironic juxtaposition. Tell us about that.
Well, that kind of sums things up. Starting in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and coming all the way to Madison, Wisconsin, and singing with the UW Marching Band, those are all things that aren't the normal track to the Met. I think being able to get to the top of the opera world and then work your way back and keep an open mind and be open to anything, and that was a thrill. The Kohl Center is, I think there are over 8,000 people there, and the Met only has 4,500. But it's my alma mater, and I'm a big sports fan. But to be backed up, I think there were, 250 musicians, and Maestro Lecrone said you get to sing whatever you want, and we went back and forth between opera and jazz. I dare anyone to top that.
Is it tough going back and forth like that so quickly?
Not for me, because I started with pop and jazz, and that's what my main focus was, and I think luckily for me, it's always been not even in the background, but on the side. And coming here was for the Wisconsin Singers, actually. And I was lucky because as an alto/tenor, that wasn't a very – in fact, I wasn't able to get into the School of Music because really my voice wasn't working.
It wasn't working.
No. I was thinking about this before I came here today. And in high school in Oconomowoc, just being able to sing – tenor, which sounds crazy, but I had nodules from acid reflux that who knew? You just don't think about those things. But I had a good ear. I could transpose and I could play keyboard by ear. So all of those things made my musical abilities valuable. I couldn't sing high, but I could bring my girlfriends in and make them tenors. Who knew? So we had 8 girl tenors and we had enough people to cover the part. And I didn't know that when I came to school, I could sing pop and I could sing jazz. And so I got into the Wisconsin Singers. But I didn't really know that that wasn't going to get you into the School of Music. But I love that kind of music and did that for a couple of years. And then I met my future husband, Scott, and he did understand how the voice worked. And he said, you can't be a tenor. He said, something's really wrong with your voice. And I thought, well, I sound pretty good. I mean, Gladys Knight and Stevie Wonder, I was singing in Stevie's octave. So I thought, well, what's wrong with that? I thought I sounded pretty good. But anyway, surgery, and I woke up a soprano. And that was happy, happy times. Because when I got the nodules removed, then my vocal folds could work the way they were supposed to. Soprano was a thrill because I'd never made those sounds before. And immediately got into voice class and immediately got into a private studio, and then we were off to the races.
Now, when did you know that you loved opera?
When I was young and my mother had a real appreciation for classical music, she would play, I remember, the Carmen Suite, an orchestral suite that didn't, I guess, equal opera vocally, but I loved it, and I made dances, and I put on costumes, and I don't know. I don't know if that wasn't vocal, but it spoke to me. I loved it, along with the Beatles. But when I got into Miss Fisher's studio, my teacher at the university, and she sent me to La Traviata at the Union, I was in the back row, but I was mesmerized. And I just thought, I loved the music and I was crying, but I thought, how do they do that? So I had an appreciation for the music, but...
No inkling that you could actually produce it?
And also I was just, I desperately wanted to know athletically, how did they do that?
And by that, do you mean the kind of sound, the vibrato?
The speed. The accuracy, the coloratura, the high notes. Because I could never sing high pitches, I've always been fascinated. It just drove me crazy. And I got back and I asked my teacher, I wanted to do exercises where I could sing coloratura. And we found out that I could do them. And then I wanted them faster and I wanted them more difficult. And she was happy. She was a big Marilyn Horne fan. And she was very happy because my voice was lyric mezzo, medium mezzo, high enough to be sort of like Friederike von Stade, medium enough to be a little bit like Marilyn Horne. She loved both. And so we were happy, happy.
Can you give us a little sample of coloratura at all, just for somebody who doesn't know what that
should I back up?
Like?
Okay. It's fast, accurate moving of notes. Okay, let me see. This is not very nice. Okay. So you're going fast. That was just a scale, but you're just trying to sing really rapidly, cleanly, with accurate pitch, not warmed up. But in a song, if you maybe hit a point of joy or there's a word or something where they wanted to really express something joyous, then they just will write these incredible passages that are very quick. I think that Sempre Libera, the end of act, I think it's act one in Traviata, the famous aria for Violetta. That's it. I mean, she just lets it go, and that's the end of Act One, and it is. And, you know, for in Barbara of Seville, which Rosina, another role that I was able to do and I love, it's so much fun. But she has a playful aria, and she's got him right where she wants him, and so she's playing. And she gets to do these kind of really fast little playful melodic moments. Those are all really fun.
So how important is acting in opera then? If you have all this vocal equipment and training, what else do you need?
Operatic performances, sometimes I have to say, and rightfully so, they receive a bad rap because a lot of times, and I've been at performances where there is just standing. The singing is beautiful. But there isn't any movement.
More like an oratorio.
Yeah. And I'm not a big fan of that because I really feel like there are lyrics, there is a story, and I'll get in a lot of trouble for this, but whatever.
You heard it here.
Yeah, I know. And my husband said, Kit. But I think that's something that really helped me along was I really wanted to portray a character. I want to portray a character. I think that's the thrill of it, and that's the excitement to study the character, to understand where you fit in the scene, what are you really trying to express. And because of my size, I receive roles where you get to jump off tables and you get to be naughty or run or have a sword fight. And I realize that, and I play pants rolls, which means I get to be the little boy.
That's where you get the sword fights.
Yeah, and Cherubino, the naughty boy in The Marriage of Figaro. I've been under furniture, and I've been hiding under tables. And
I think you played Hansel, too, right?
Yes. And those are the ones that are the roles that are fun for me. I understand, too, there are so many difficult roles. You do not want to do anything but stand there and sing. And I've had the opportunity to work with so many phenomenal artists that really, through their musical performance, they don't have to move a muscle. Unfortunately, I've also been in productions where it doesn't work. You know, there just isn't enough going on musically. When you're in a 4,500-seat house, they can't really see your face. But unfortunately, in some of the smaller theaters, the regional theaters, you really do have to work harder than some of the people that don't really seem to work that hard. I know when I'm sitting there in an audience, I really want to understand what's going on. I want to see and I want to experience the drama. And there was a beautiful production here, Madison Opera, and a tenor, very good tenor friend of mine was in it. I think it was Lucia recently. And my husband and I were at the dress rehearsal, and we were close enough to watch. And it was just beautiful because it was Bob, the aria, the orchestra, and the character. And when that happens, you're just transported. I don't think I took a breath. I don't think I moved. I think I just watched, listened, and I was kind of taken away. I wish that happened more often.
And why do you think opera has sort of, in this country, a reputation of being for the elite? Or a lot of people think they're not going to like an opera. They're not going to experience ever that transportation to this other world that you just described. Why do you think that is? That you know, we might go hear you with a marching band by accident, but a lot of people don't sign up to go to the opera.
Let me start by saying some positive things are super titles. I think a lot of times the foreign language kept audiences away because it is really frustrating to not have an idea of what's being said. A synopsis in the program is helpful. Super titles, I think, are really helpful. Here I go again. But diction is very important because I really am a big proponent of understanding what is being said. And I just feel like, especially if you're going to an opera in English, I really feel that that's very important that you understand what's being sung. And the super titles make it more understandable. I'm going and I understand what they are trying to sing in Italian and German and French. I think people stay away from opera because of the length. If it's 3.5 hours, I just think it's difficult to go and to take in something of that length that maybe is brand new. Musical theater is more lively. It has a lighter story, except for Les Mis or something like that.
That's a light one.
I know. I can just speak for the people that I run into in my hometown or in the grocery store or something like that, and their honest question is, how long is it? What language is it in? What's the story about? And I think those are very honest questions, and I think those are probably some reasons why. Crazy for You versus, well, let's not talk about Wagner because that's a whole different story.
Well, what about the intensity of the singing, though? I mean, it's a whole different level from what you would experience in a Broadway musical.
Boy, and I'm hoping, and I don't know. I mean, I wonder how many people really understand, too, the difficulty of what is being produced vocally. And I say to my students, too, there's such an athletic aspect to singing with that kind of volume, and then for 3 hours, and it's shared, you know, not one person is singing that long, but you have to be in really top physical condition. You have to really understand how to take care of the small mechanism with the tiny strips of muscle. I just think that it's athletic, and I think that, boy, these are such good questions. Because I've been so engrossed in this for 25 years, it's hard for me to go to an opera and not totally be focused in on how was that note? How did they do that cutoff? Wow, that was a great, you know, high note. Was that loud enough? You know, did they take that diminuendo down? I mean, I wish I could go back and just sit and experience it. But I'm sure it's like a football player or, you know, maybe a jazz trumpet player. I mean, can you really go and can you just
right. Yeah, it's like what Mark Twain said about being a river pilot. You know, suddenly the river lost all its beauty because he was looking for snags and undercurrents and impediments and
or
things like that.
Or how about people like yourselves listening to a radio program?
That's right. It's never the same.
That's right. And I wish it were. But I was thinking about, you know, watching Michael Jordan. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. I guess I don't understand how difficult it is if I were a basketball player, but it's a beautiful, fun thing to watch. Makes it look easy.
But a lot of people do seem to come to opera, or a lot of the opera audience seems to come to it later in life. I mean, that's been often observed.
That's very true. And I think that's the trick of marketing, too, that I notice, especially going to regional companies. That's the trick when we attend maybe a fundraiser or a pre-opening night gala. It is exciting to see there are definitely younger people there, younger board members and younger people attending the fundraisers, and hats off, because it really is important to get that crowd involved.
And maybe to make it opera more accessible to a wider audience. I remember going to the Met when I was only 8, I think, with mm-hmm. my grandparents, and it seemed there were a lot of people in fur coats who were more interested in showing off their fashion than they were listening to the music. You know, there is this kind of other side of opera as showing off.
Do you want me to tell stories or not?
We are all ears.
Okay. Well, let's see. I think one of the things that is interesting is actually the most expensive tickets, unfortunately, are, of course, in the very front row. And really and truly, when I've at a dress rehearsal or a final dress, when I've sat in those seats, they're definitely not the ones that I would like to sit in as far as acoustic, or you're really in a place where we can see you. And
really?
Uh-huh. And we can see when you're getting tired.
Is that a euphemism for sleeping in your mink?
Well, and we always say it's very warm and that you probably enjoyed a large meal. But it seems to be that the expensive tickets near the front are they're heavily minked. And I think that's very, very expensive seats. And it would be interesting to see as time goes on, you know, what different kind of coats will be
it would turn up
behind
in the front row.
I am so in trouble here.
Well, it would be very interesting. Well, and you know,
I'm in trouble.
I've heard that the dress code, certainly for instrumental classical music, has changed over the years. I mean, does that make a difference to you if that person in the front row is wearing blue jeans?
You know, I'm so happy, because when we look out and those seats are filled, then we know we're in good shape. And that's the neat thing. The Met is such an incredible place, because even one of my students, she's in seventh grade, and she came, you know, bustling into her lesson, and she said, "Well, I just saw the Barber of Seville," and I thought, "Oh, that's great." She said, "Yeah, at the Met." I said, "Did you like it?" She said, "I loved it." And I thought, great. The audiences are so varied there, mm-hmm. and it's always full there. And she loved it. She loved every minute of it. And that's an exciting thing, of course, about that place. But really and truly, as I've sung regionally, there's lots of younger people, young, you know, high school, middle school, that are in the aisles, and they're all dressed up. And they are really, they're there. After the second intermission, they're still there. So,
well, you know, one thing that I think unites opera with popular music in concert, I mean, as opposed to instrumental classical music, is the ability of the audience to respond spontaneously to what's going on. In other words, if you hear a Mozart piano concerto and it's a really fantastic first movement, you're considered usually gauche or somehow uneducated if you applaud or cheer,
right,
you know, at the end of the cadenza. Whereas in opera, you know, when that high note hits, you can go crazy.
It's so exciting. That is so true. And that's even backstage, you know, we're hanging out there and we've got to, you know, it gets to be a team. It really does. And we're pulling for each other and we're just hoping. And luckily with the people that There's a point I want to make about that, too. But I've been just honored to sing with these people anywhere in these – in the regional houses where I think people think that the quality of singing tends to lessen. No. No way. Everybody wants to work. And the level of singing is so amazing. But you're stage right and you're hanging out. You're thinking, come on, come on. And we get to cheer, you know, because nobody can hear us. And they hit it and the, you know, the audience goes crazy. We're like, yeah, you know, and it's just, or we're in our dressing room and we hit it, you know, we hear it over the our speaker in our dressing room. And that is so exciting because it's live and you can have that immediate reaction. And they've got that, you know, coloratura passage, or they have that diminuendo cutoff. And when we're backstage, we can do it, you know.
We're going to follow you to the Met, find out how you got there and what it was like when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest, Kit Reuter-Foss, the mezzo-soprano who has come from Oconomowoc and Madison to Milwaukee and then to the Metropolitan Opera, where she has performed many times. The envy of many a singer, both a budding singer and singers who have already, you know, you might say missed the boat. So what made it click for you? How did you get there?
I won the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions, and it's a very interesting and painstaking way to get there. They have district auditions, which always occurred in Milwaukee. Then you get to the regional auditions in Minneapolis, and you have to win both to get to the finals in New York City. And this happens all over. I think Puerto Rico probably is the furthest from New York City. And I tried so many times. But again, my competitive, I thought, I'm going to win this thing. And also, young, married with two children, the prize money was very interesting. And also in Milwaukee, you get performing opportunities. So I felt like if I did well, and it did happen, I got to perform with the Milwaukee Chamber Orchestra and got a lot of experience that way. And you would be judged by some very interesting judges. Their comments were helpful. And there were judges from the Met, and there were judges from universities throughout the Midwest.
You just sing through your nerves?
Five arias, always one 20th century aria. And first time, I did fairly well. I think I took third. You think you're going to win the whole thing. Next time, I took fifth, backwards. But then my teacher and I started to realize there were two or three arias that were just suited. Figaro always won, Cherubino. And the letter scene from Massenet's Werther, of Friederike von Stade, a copy from her aria album. And Miss Fisher and I, we just knew. And that one I took all the way to the Met, and I won with that aria. So was lucky to find a few that were just suited. Also, very interesting, a Handel coloratura aria, Furibondo spira il vento, from Partenope.
Not exactly one that you're at the Met very
often. No. Maybe done at the Met once. I can't remember. Maybe not. The coloratura a la Marilyn Horne, very unusual. The 1-2 punch of those, one in Milwaukee, three times in Minneapolis for the regionals. I took third, I took second, and then the last time I tied. Of course, nothing ever came very easily, but I tied with a baritone and a woman that ran the Young Artist Program at the Met, Gail Robinson, came up to me and she whispered in my ear. She said, do those two for the finals. I don't know if that was fair or not.
Good advice.
Uh-huh. And when I received my winner's check, I kissed the man who gave me the check. And he fainted against the wall.
What did you do to him? What did you do to him?
That will be in my book also. He just slid down the back wall again.
That's quite
very
a kiss.
Operatic.
Totally typical.
But you must have been so persistent.
Persistent.
You know, just to continue despite,
never,
you know,
give up. Yeah. Never give up. And got out there and always, again, the oldest contestant. And I have to say, every time I look, my journey is exactly opposite of everyone else's. I give voice lessons to students. They can start in the fifth grade. So we start maybe with some Broadway literature, but I give them classical foreign language songs. So some of these kids will sing Italian arias all the way from fifth grade. They go to college as voice majors. They go to graduate school. They go to operatic summer programs or opera apprentice programs. This is who I sing with all the time. No one's story is my story. But I was the oldest contestant. They said that all the time. There were 21 finalists. They chose 10 winners. And it was 2 men and 8 women. And we sang with the orchestra for the finals. And then we sang live on the radio for the winner's concert, which was broadcast all over the world. Not too much pressure.
Does broadcasting make any difference to you?
By that time, who cares? It was like, what can you do?
We care
to me?
Quite a bit, actually, yeah, but I can understand where you're coming from.
It was after, by that time, you just walked out on stage and you knew what the acoustic was. You knew what the orchestra felt like. And by that time, and I must say that all the way through, they treated the contestants, we were treated with so much care and kindness. And you got to coach with the best coaches there, and they were just so kind and understanding. And because I was sort of the mother hen, 2 or 3 times I got sent into an extra room or a restroom because someone was crying. There was a 21-year-old contestant, and I was 33, and I had 2 children. So I couldn't imagine what that would have been like.
So much pressure.
Oh. Yeah.
And then besides winning a nice check, what kind of opportunity did winning
bring? Well, again, crazy. I went back to Verona and, well, here, we'll just say it all. I was doing the laundry and got a call from Lenore Rosenberg, who's the casting director at the Met, 6 weeks later, and she made me an offer for 6 months contract at the Met for Second Lady in Magic Flute and for an Esquire in Parsifal.
That's a good variety.
Very. Mm-hmm. And I immediately turned down the Wagner, which, again, not very bright. But I had 2 children, and it was a 6-month contract.
Well, how many performances does that mean, and how much of that time do you actually have to spend in New York?
Well, let me see. For Magic Flute, I was there from December 1st to February 16th, and then I would have had to stay all the way till the end of the season for the end of Parsifal. That would have been May. So December to May, and I just couldn't do it. So I took a chance. And luckily, that wasn't the end of things. But I did. Lenore knew my situation, and she was there. You know, she was one of our judges for the finals of the Met competition. So right off the bat, probably not the smartest thing to do, but I just had to do it.
It's that old career family bind.
Well, you hit a compromise, though.
Yes, and it worked that time. It's another story later on, but that's how it happened. And went out, and I was covering the first, I can't remember, maybe 8 performances of Magic Flute, and then the 9th one was my debut. So I was ready to go on as the Second Lady for the first 8, I believe, and then the 9th one I was scheduled to do my debut.
And how did that go?
By then, you were ready. It was really fun. Again, the first day I was under contract at 9 o'clock in the morning when I was just getting used to New York City, I got a call that the Second Lady was under the weather.
Oh, a classic understudy
mm-hmm.
situation.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, I did the mature thing, was I started crying and I called my husband. And he said, "What are you there for? This is what you've been waiting your whole life for." So I walked because I really wasn't comfortable in a cab. All I can say is I really hadn't spent a lot of time in New York, and I just didn't feel comfortable in a cab. That's all I can say. I wasn't sure where the cab would ever take me. And that's just how I was. I hadn't done a lot of traveling, and you may laugh all you want, but I really had probably seen too many mystery programs on television. And so I walked.
So, but this is New York in January or February or something
like
that?
I didn't care.
Doesn't
it was
that
a lot of exercise.
Your voice after
I
a while?
Could care less at that point. I was ready to go to the Met. I thought, I got to get there. I don't know where am I going. I'm going to walk down Columbus. I know where it is.
Right.
I got to get there, and I have to get there on time, so I'm going to walk. Seriously, I had to get there on time. I was worried. What if it had a flat tire? I had to get there.
Now, how much notice did they give you for this, then?
It was at 9:30. No, it was at 10 o'clock. Rehearsals always start at 10. I got called about 9:15.
Okay.
Oh, my
so
goodness.
That's why you were
walking.
Sort of
so instant.
To be sure to get
yes,
there.
Yes. I was. I just thought, my luck, we'd have a flat tire. My first rehearsal, I'd
traffic
be late.
Jam, whatever.
Whatever. So I got there, and first cast, which meant all the stars and me. I was the only cover in the room. And these were big-time first cast people.
Who were they?
Francisco Araiza. Let's see, the Queen of the Night wasn't there. Kathleen Battle wasn't there yet. She was Pamina. Oh, wonderful tenor. Oh, Kit, he's going to be mad at me. Fantastic tenor, good friend of mine. And then first and third lady, who was at the piano. Levine wasn't in there at that time. But anyway, was a secondary conductor who was also, when I walked in, I thought, okay, a gigantic spear to stab something. I don't know if I was, I must have been stabbing the dragon, who was some extra. And then, oh, I know, Araiza fell on the floor, and the spear was so heavy that I really kind of hit him with it. And I was trying to sing in German. I was trying to remember and do everything correctly, and I had the wrong clothes on. You know, I was too dressed up because I wanted to look great for my first day, so I had the wrong shoes on, and I was off balance, and the spear weighed about 20 pounds, and everything went wrong. And I was just, it was
so
very...
So you actually speared the
well,
tenor?
Well, I hit him with it in, like, on his neck or, you know, and it was a blunt spear. It wasn't sharp, but it was very heavy. It was a big prop, and everyone sort of laughed, and we took a break, and... You know, just sums it up. You know, did it go smoothly? No. Was everyone laughing? Yes. Did everyone want to know who she was? Yes. So you have to laugh. What are you going to do? I didn't hurt anyone, but Francisco Araiza, you know, looks up and he's like, oh, who is this? You know, cover number 85. And then after that, the cover Queen of the Night took me under her wing, and she was a fabulous singer, and she was very nice. And so we did things together, and the regular first lady was also very nice. And there's a cafeteria, beautiful cafeteria, of course. And then people see that you're new, and the people that do supporting roles there that are there for years, one of their specialties is to welcome you and walk you through things, and then you feel just great, and they take care of you.
Spear notwithstanding, are you glad that you started with Mozart?
Yes. He's my favorite. Yes. And perfect. I love Mozart's my favorite.
And doesn't kill the voice the way some other composers can.
And I'm so lucky because I've never had any experiences that really hurt my voice. I do get hired for a lot of Mozart, Rossini, and then my parts are small, you know.
So how many performances would you actually be doing in the course of a week at the Met?
Two.
You do the
Saturday. You do a Tuesday and a Saturday, mm-hmm. something like that.
And what are some of the stories you can tell us of things that happened during performances besides that sleeping first row and the heavy sword and different things? What are some of the – I guess if you had a treasury of your greatest moments so far at the Met, what would some of those be? Greatest either most wonderful or most memorable or
being on stage with incredible singers that it's come so easily to them. I mean, I remember being in a scene with Jerry Hadley, always one of my favorites. I remember when I was in the competition and I went to Don Giovanni and you got free passes and he was singing Dalla Sua Pace, Giovanni, and he was upstage by himself, and it was just him spotted, you know. And I'd never heard singing like that in my life because it was pure and honest, and his diction was perfect. And again, I think I just froze. So then to be in a scene with him, and he was saying things – oh, it was Traviata, and I was Flora. And he was saying things to me like, you're doing great. Hey, you know, sounds great, Flora. But for them to turn around and sing gorgeously out at the Met and then turn and say things supportive – it was that when Kathleen Battle was Pamina and I had done – when I was finished with my debut and the curtain closed, she took a beautiful, you know, grand bow. And then she came backstage and she found me and she said, now you're Kit. And I said, yes, I about fainted. And she said, it's your debut. And I said, yes. She said, congratulations. You did a great job. It was those kind of things where
– she's not someone known for lavishing praise, to say the least.
But at that time, it was 1991, I think, that was a – well, I can only speak for what I saw in the Kathleen Battle that I worked with, different. And in the Queen of the Night, Luciana Serra, my daughter Erica, who was 5 at the time, I looked stage left and Erica was sitting on her lap. I'm like, Erica, what are you doing? But that's, I think that's the thing, is beautiful singing, incredible handling of the pressure, and yet having my daughter on her lap, you know, playing with a puppet. And I don't even think Miss Sarah spoke very much English. And at one time, Plácido Domingo was practicing the star dressing room. It was the main one. And he was practicing going over things at the piano. And I was going up in the elevator and I just looked at him and I thought, you better keep going because I'm sure, you know, I'm just staring at him. There he is. What are you doing? You're just staring at him. And I thought, Kit, you know, you've got a fitting. Go upstairs. Stop acting like a kid.
What about the problem of divas? You know, the stereotypical divas.
Or divos, for that matter.
Never. I think because I was secondary, I did small parts and I was covering. I never was in a situation where I had to be a part of that kind of behavior. I spent a little bit of time with Kiri Takanawa. It was a relaxed time. Spent a little bit of time with Carol Van Ness. Again, I think my times with them was relaxed. Dolores Ziegler, one of my favorite performers in the whole world, she's magical. And then I got the opportunity to work with her in regional situations, same person. And those are my idols, the performers at the Met that were exactly the same wonderful people, whether we were in that building or not. I think that kind of behavior comes out when the pressure is really high. And in Ghosts of Versailles, a lot of pressure because it was a world premiere, stars in and out. And there were a few times where it wasn't diva behavior, but it was strange behavior. And that's where the what I call, not the lifers, but the people that have been at the Met in supporting roles for many, many, many years. That's where I just would kind of go over and stand next to them and they would put it all in perspective. They would just roll their eyes and they'd seen it a million times, this kind of bizarre behavior.
I've got to ask one example of bizarre behavior.
How about crawling up on the conductor's lap and kind of acting like being in kindergarten?
That's
don't you think that's bizarre?
Yeah.
When the person was maybe in their late 50s? I don't know. I've never seen that one before.
Is it tougher, do you think? You mentioned Ghost of Versailles. Is it tougher, do you think, at first in particular, if it's a new opera and you really don't know how the audience is going to react to it and the notes are new and the moves are new to everybody?
I think because, again, I had such a small role that I don't think the pressure is at all on those kind of roles. I have to say, too, when Maestro Levine was involved in anything that I did there, so patient, I never saw him in any situation where he wasn't patient and, you know, in a really positive mood. That's what I was a part of. Ghosts of Versailles, we had a lot of things going on. There were 75 people on stage, I think, at a time. We had some really big chorus numbers. Two really interesting things that happened. One, we were on stage and a big, heavy, decorative cherub fell fell seriously from the high, from up high in
fatally
the ceiling.
High.
Yeah. And Tracy Dahl was there and Renee Fleming was there. And it could have really, really seriously injured someone. That was really scary. I also was supposed to ride in a chair across from stage left to stage right. The chair was suspended from the ceiling, whatever you want to call it. I tried that. I was supposed to hold a parasol. Nope. Nope. I refused. I am afraid of heights. And that maybe was a diva. I was third gossip or second gossip or something. And I just told him, sorry.
Not worth risking your life
sorry,
for
guys.
Third gossip.
Nope. 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 So my cover did that. I couldn't do it. And also at the end of Act One, it was the dress rehearsal, I think. There was a big explosion on stage, and that was supposed to happen. And we all fell down on the edge of the stage, and a large bar holding a beautiful, beautiful silk, huge curtain. The bar fell, and it just missed us and hit the edge of the orchestra pit. And I really think that it might have broken. I kind of remember that it broke an instrument or something. That could have been a disaster. Mm-hmm. We knew something happened, but we didn't move because our stage direction was to freeze. But we were laying there. We were covered with some kind of material we had never been covered with before. So, you know, I mean, there's things like that that crazy.
Speaking of things unexpected, we'll begin our next part of this conversation with some music that would be not what you'd expect for a Metropolitan Opera singer to participate in. Right after this, when we return shortly, this is University of the Air.
Can't go a day without me. If the bling was a drug, I die from an overdose. Stress, press a sugar loaf. Homie, I'm the most you seen. I got the same effects on both coasts. And anything hot on both wheels, homie, I'm close to you. Stop trying to be me. Stop trying to be he. Stop trying to do what you see. Do you? Cause right here is my little homie. Go back to where you came from and get your own homie. Do you? It's so, so sloppy in the fans. No one.
That's the song Do You by Bow Wow. And if you listen closely at the end, you hear the voice of our guest, Kit Reuterfoss. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we were talking about singing at the Met. So what are we doing in that song?
Well, I was singing with the Atlanta Opera, and they got a call. Bow Wow does his recording at So-So Def Records, and it's DEF. Their studio is in Atlanta, and they got a call, and they wanted an opera singer to put some background vocals, and they said, actually, they didn't say at that time, they just wanted someone to come over to the studio. And because Atlanta Opera knew that I was able to do things like that, they said, would you do it? Of course. Because, again, a little extra money while I was down there. I think I was doing Giovanni or Cozy, I can't remember. Maybe it was Cozy. My husband was down there at the time, and so anyway, they sent a black Escalade with tinted windows. I was like, okay.
You have arrived.
Oh, yeah. So we got to the studio, and I'm so glad that Scott came because we got in. There were three or four young men in the control area. And then I went into the recording booth. No music, no score, nothing.
No other singer?
Nothing. And no one really had an idea of what they wanted. So Scott started asking for anyone to describe anything. And we finally came up with a description of a ghost-like sound, a scary sound, to be over the top. And we said, ooh. That's great. And we said, ooh, what pitch? Well, just whatever you want to do. So we listened to the track, and we finally figured out that it was in a minor key. We didn't have any idea. So then we just played around, and we kind of came up with some kind of like a background melody, which I think we could hear a little bit. And then I did it until they liked it. And then they tracked it six or seven times over, and they gave me a check and put me back in the vehicle and they took me back to the hotel.
No questions asked.
No. It was just a really cool experience. But it was interesting because there was nothing.
Do you think it was something that they really needed an opera singer for?
I really don't. Good question. I don't know. I had one other – this is another thing that happened in Atlanta. I'll tell you really quickly. But another awesome experience that I think happened because I can do crossover. I got an opportunity to do a live performance. Bobby McFerrin, when he comes to a city, he does live performances. Like he'll have a percussionist and he'll have a tap dancer or something like that. So he came to the Rialto Theater and they wanted an opera singer. So again, I was in town. I don't know what I was doing. And I got the call. So I didn't know what to do. I went over. His pianist was there. No one else. What am I supposed to do? Do an operatic aria. Okay, I did the habanera. He's going to sing with you. He wasn't there. Okay, and then what? Well, you can do whatever you want. If he likes you, he'll keep you for a second number. If not, you'll be done. Okay, full house, live. Go on stage, there he is. I don't get any chance to be like, ooh, Bobby McFerrin. We start the aria. He sings the chorus in French behind me. Perfect. So I thought, I'm not leaving. I don't care what he does. So I had told the pianist we're doing Summer Over the Rainbow in C. Just hit it. So we started and I started and then I stopped and I said, I can't sing with you. I said, we need to sit together in chairs. So we stopped it. I didn't want to stand above Bobby McFerrin while he sat in a chair. So we got two chairs. Our knees were touching, and we sang Somewhere Over the Rainbow together in a jazz form. I took a bow, and I left.
With no rehearsals?
None.
Just walk on, do it.
Be happy, don't worry.
Sort of spontaneously do the second one, and you're out.
Out. Probably one of the most amazing. Bow wow is bow wow. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, crossover, being able to cross over, that was one of the most amazing things that's ever happened to me.
And let's say you're going to do something like Somewhere Over the Rainbow and make it now not opera, but something else. What do you do differently with your voice, with your body, with everything else?
First of all, you take the athletic drive off of your voice. You take the breath support. In other words, you don't have to put out as much volume, so you don't have to use as much strength and put the breath through. I don't want to get too technical, but I can really lay off on the strength for the breath support. And then because I know what I want it to sound like, I can play with the vibrato and I can take it off and just put it at the end of the phrase where I would like it to be. And then take the shape out so that it doesn't have that operatic, thicker sound and put it more towards a Broadway sound or a pop sound that's thinner and much more speech-like.
So maybe less chesty?
Less full. So those are things that you do immediately upon making the sound because I know what I want it to sound like. And that just comes from doing it your whole life. But those kind of experiences are... Bow Wow was just really fun. And, you know, it was... Janet Jackson's boyfriend walked through. You know, never thought I'd see him.
No wardrobe malfunction there.
Right.
Any experiences you've had at other opera houses, like in other countries, that are memorable?
Japan was interesting, and working with Seiji Ozawa was a thrill. And that was the Met. We went over there on tour, and then we also toured with Little Women. Actually, we did Little Women with the New York City Opera. So that was weird that both opera companies from Lincoln Center, both of them, we took to Japan. Seiji Ozawa, it was amazing. And we had a first cast, another first cast, flute cast from the Met. Barbara Bonney and Sumi Jo was our queen of the night. Amazing.
Alert audiences over there.
Wonderful. Actually stood at the bottom of the escalator with Ghost of Versailles recordings looking for second gossip autographs. I thought, this is really weird.
Collecting them all.
Right. Obviously, they're at the bottom of the list. I was like, what are you doing?
Is there a part that you ever have thought, gosh, I wish I could have sung that, or gosh, I'd really like to sing that?
I wish I could have done Carmen a few more times.
Doesn't get much better than that.
No. All the Mozart roles that I wanted to do, I got a chance to do.
And you made it to the Met?
A little early.
It sounds as if you have not lost that sense of thrill about the whole adventure.
Oh, no. No. It's crazy. My daughters live in New York City, and, yeah, they haven't really either. I went out. They flew me there for my birthday, and they said, Mom, we're going to take you to that favorite restaurant that we used to go to across from Lincoln Center. So it's very special to them, too. I'm glad. They were 9 and 5. And I think running around backstage at the Met, that's something I'm glad they got to experience too.
Well, we're glad we got to experience an hour with you, Kit Reuter-Foss, and filling us in backstage and certainly in terms of a broad career too. I think we've covered just the most extreme of the bases and touched some of the ones in between. Great treat to have you with us this
hour. My pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
Thank you.